In May of 1990, the cargo ship Hansa Carrier was hit by a severe storm during its voyage from South Korea to the United States. A large wave swept 21 shipping crates into the sea, five of which contained Nike shoes. About 6 months later, a beach scavenger named Steve McLeod spotted a clump of Nikes while walking along the Oregon coast. Then another pile, then several more piles of the footwear, and soon McLeod's Cannon Beach apartment was packed with several styles and sizes of Nikes, each of which he carefully cleaned and dried and debarnacled. There was only one problem. The vast majority of the shoes were left-footed. No right-footed shoes. The phenomenon attracted the attention of several local scientists who were working to decipher the Pacific Ocean's currents. And they began to look into it, and with the help of Nike and the Hansa crew, they determined that the shoes had never been connected during their ocean voyage. They hadn't been tied together in boxes or something like that. And they determined that the slight toe curvature of the right-footed shoes caused them to tack into the southern-bound California coast current. That's right. And the left-footed shoes went this way. The end result was that after several months, a small physical difference between each shoe ended up miles and miles apart. And so Steve McLeod connected with some of his buddies who also were scavengers in the beach. And they talked, and sure enough, there was a large number of shoes that had beached to the north along the Queen Charlotte Sound. A meeting was arranged, and in one day, 1,200 pairs of Nike shoes were reunited with their mates using the serial numbers. That very slight difference had caused miles of difference in terms of where they ended up on the coastline. Little differences lead to big changes in the currents of God's will, too. 1 Samuel chapter 9 this morning, the story of Saul is the story of little coincidences that seem to be going nowhere. A lot of little details, but they are all directed by the hand of God. Life may seem like a winding path of futility at times. Verses 1 through 4 of 1 Samuel 9. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Aphia, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Take now with you one of the servants and arise, go search for the donkeys." And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim. He passed through the land of Shalishah, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shaalim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. All right, Saul grew up in the village of Gibeah. We learned that later in 1 Samuel. He was from a wealthy family. His father Kish is called a mighty man of valor, which certainly in its original sense had a military meaning, but now often simply meant a leading citizen, a nobleman, a wealthy man, a man of position or honor in the tribe. Literally, the expression means a man of substance. Saul was an impressive man himself. He was, we're told, tall and handsome. The word literally is good, means excellent, it means impressive. Our first impression of Saul, and remember, we're set up to be thinking about a search for a king, because that's how we left off chapter 8. Our first impression of Saul and the traits that people notice about him had to do with his physical appearance. He looked like the kind of man you would want as your king. But the story of the first king of Israel begins with a search for some donkeys. Seems like an odd way for the story to begin. Kish sends out Saul looking for a group of donkeys that have wandered from the area. And he sends along a trusted servant with his son. The New American Standard translates it simply as one of the servants, but it is very possible to translate the Hebrew here as the first of the servants. And later we will see that this servant was was a person deserving some respect. At the end of the chapter, he's actually enjoys a seat of honor along with Saul at a special feast. The expression was used in those days of the head servant or the manager of the estate. So this servant was quite possibly Kish's top business manager sent along to help his young son on the search. He might even have been Ziba, who is later named as the manager of all of Saul's properties. The two of them set out looking for donkeys. Now, donkeys are certainly valuable property in the ancient world, but this donkey search takes on a life of its own. In fact, we're given an itinerary for the search, a search pattern. But the search pattern doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you look at it. Gibeah is in the tribal territory of Benjamin, just to the north of the city of Jerusalem. The central plateau is a hilly plateau with many ravines and valleys where animals could be lost, so it would make sense to look around the area for the donkeys. How far could a few donkeys wander, after all? But Saul doesn't seem to spend a whole lot of time in the immediate area. He heads northeast into the tribal territory of Ephraim, and he wanders through the hill country of central Ephraim, eventually making his way back to the territory of Benjamin in a big circle. In fact, we're told he is on this trip for 3 days. Now, the place names used here cannot be identified with certainty, but we can make some educated guesses. The guesses we make show a rather circuitous route. The trip looks something like this on the map. Saul heads towards the Jordan River Valley and then around through Ephraim, then back down through into the central plateau of Benjamin. It's a 3-day trip. It's a pretty much a constant traveling trip to make it that distance in those days. That's a long way to go looking for some donkeys. It also seems like a rather odd process to go through as you look for donkeys. He is committed to finding the donkeys, at least it seems like that. Although one wonders if he wasn't out for a nice jaunt along the way. But he spends a great deal of effort for no results. Life can seem like that sometimes, can't it? The path of life twists and turns in odd ways. What is this all about anyway? Why am I doing this? Where will it all end? When will it end? First of all, life may seem like a winding path of futility, but secondly, the spiritually clueless fail to see the spiritual clues. Verse 5. When they came to the land of Zuf, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come and let us return, lest my father cease to be concerned about the donkeys and become worried about us." And he said to him, that is, the servant said to him, "Behold, now there's a man of God in this city, and the man is held in honor. All that he says surely comes true. Now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us about our journey on which we have set out." Then Saul said to his servant, "But behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sack, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" And the servant answered Saul again and said, "Behold, I have in my hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God, and he will tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, "Come and let us go to the seer." For he was called a prophet, now was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. All right, here's an aerial view of the region showing the hill country through which Saul passed in his search. He continued to search until finally he comes to, we're told, the land of Zuph. Now, we've heard that name before in 1 Samuel. How many of you remember it? Oh, see? We're going to give a test at the end of this study, you know? 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 1, the very beginning of 1 Samuel. Because Elkanah, Samuel's father, had an ancestor. In fact, Samuel's great-great-great-grandfather was named Zuph. The land of Zuph is Samuel's property, his family property. So we know what Saul did not know. He is now in the home territory of Samuel the prophet, although in this story, the narrator simply calls him the man of God for quite a while. Somewhere near the town of Ramah, on the border between Benjamin and Ephraim, Saul is ready to turn back and go home. He tells his servant that they should go back so his father won't worry about him. The search has been futile. No results. They've failed. But the servant knows more than Saul. The servant knows that this is the hometown of Samuel, the man of God. He suggests that they go and ask Samuel for help in finding the donkeys. By the way, the name Saul means in the Hebrew to ask. So Saul is named as an asker. He is an asking person. He is one who asks. And so the servant says, let's go ask the prophet. But he uses an interesting expression. He doesn't say, let's go ask him about the donkeys. That's what Saul is thinking about. He says in verse 6, perhaps he, that is the prophet, can tell us about our journey on which we have set out. And that's a rather curious way to express this whole thing. We get the impression that the servant seems to think there's more to this strange trip than searching for donkeys. At the very least, the narrator who is writing this story certainly is giving the impression that there's much more to the coincidences of this trip than a search for donkeys. So the suggestion is to ask Samuel what our trip was all about anyway. Well, I thought I knew what it was about. It was about searching for donkeys. Not really. Why has God led us on this rather winding path of futility? Now, the sense is heightened in the story. Part of the problem we have when we read biblical stories is we already know the ending, so it sort of loses its interest. But this sense is heightened when we read about the money. It was customary when you sought advice from a prophet that you would pay the prophet for that advice. And Saul and the servant certainly know that. And so when the servant says, let's go ask the man of God, Saul says, well, we don't have anything. Used up all our money, all our food. We don't have anything to give him. And the servant says, behold, half a shekel of silver in my hand. Except that in the Hebrew, there's a big element of surprise in the way this is expressed. He says, behold, that's like saying, wow. Okay? It's an exclamation. Wow! A half a shekel! And he says, has been found in my hand, literally. It's like I stuck my hand in my pocket and look at that! Money! Where did it come from? Well, he's shocked. But there's a purpose behind all of this, isn't there? And that's what we're meant to start to see, the clues of the divine hand behind all of these coincidences. Have you ever had an experience like that? You're frustrated with what seems to be a rather wasted path in life, but there are little indicators that there is something more going on in your circumstances than you thought. Saul doesn't seem to get the clues here. All the way through this story, we get the impression that Saul is sort of spiritually clueless. Now, one of the big debates, and you know, you open up the commentaries and all of the things that talk about this passage, and one of the big debates about this passage that all of the critics talk about, especially those who are critical of the scriptures in particular and their authority, one of the big debates is why doesn't Saul seem to know about Samuel and that he's in the hometown of the leader of the nation of Israel? For all generation now, Samuel has been leading the nation of Israel. You see, the hometown of Saul, Gibeah, is only about 5 miles from where he is right now at Ramah. How could he not know where he was? And how could he not seem to not know about Samuel and not recognize Samuel, not even seem to know about the man of God? And so the critics all say, well, you know, this is a concocted story. But it isn't. It's in God's word. Why didn't Saul know? I suspect that Saul didn't know because he's basically spiritually clueless. He's like many today. We believe in God. That's good. But God's not really a big part of our lives. We're too busy solving all of our important business and family problems ourselves. It's not that we deny God. We just ignore God. He's not central in our lives. And as a result, we're spiritually clueless. And folks, the spiritually clueless fail to see the spiritual clues that God embeds in the circumstances of their lives. We fail to understand what God is about to do, that He's going to do something in our lives that we don't expect, because we haven't seen the little clues that God has left in the circumstances of our lives. We don't see it coming like Saul. Third, God specializes in timing the events of our lives. Look at verse 11. And as they went up the slope to the city, they found young women going out to draw water, and said to them, "Is the seer here, the prophet?" And they said, and they answered them and said, "He is. See, he is ahead of you. Hurry now, for he has come into the city today, for the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore, go up, for you will find him at once." So they went up to the city, and they came into the city. As they came into the city, behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to go up to the high place. God is a timing expert. He knows just how to coordinate the schedules of people, even when they don't know they're being coordinated. God choreographed the timing of multiple schedules here in this chapter. In fact, as we shall see, God choreographed the schedule of an entire group of 30 representatives of Israel to be ready for a feast and the arrival of Saul at the end of this story. He also choreographed the schedule of Samuel and Saul to arrive all together at this precise moment. God does that sort of thing. So Saul and his servant innocently start up the hill to the town. Towns in the ancient world were built on the top of hills, but the water supply was at the bottom. And in the culture of the day, who were the water carriers? The young ladies. That was your job. You were the water carriers, and young ladies would go out in the evening when it got a little cool. They'd go down to where they got the water, and they'd draw the water, and they'd carry it back to their family homes in the village up on the top of the hill. So as they're headed toward the village, they meet a group of young women who are there to get the water supply for their families. And the young women get excited. There's a sense of urgency now in the story. Go, hurry up, go. The man of God has just returned today, not yesterday. He may be gone tomorrow. He just came home today. Now remember that Samuel traveled, we learned, a circuit of four cities where he worked for the nation of Israel as the leader of the nation. So Saul has arrived after all his three-day wanderings precisely on the day that Samuel has arrived home after his travels. Not a day too soon or a day too late. Saul heads up the hill to the town gate to arrive just as Samuel is coming out of the gate to go up to the sanctuary for a special feast. The name Ramah is short for Ramathaim, which is a form which indicates two hilltops. And apparently there was a center of worship on the top of the other hill. Samuel is headed out and going to a feast. They meet precisely according to God's timetable. That's the timing of God's appointment calendar. God is a master of timing the schedules of our lives. Late one evening, a professor sat at his desk working on the next day's lectures for his students. He shuffled through the papers and mail placed there by his housekeeper. He began to throw the mail into the wastebasket when one magazine, which wasn't even addressed to him, was delivered to his office by mistake, caught his attention. It fell open to an article titled "The Needs of the Congo Mission." The professor began reading it rather idly, but then he was consumed by these words: "The need is great here. We have no one to work the northern province of Gabon in the central Congo. And it is my prayer as I write this article that God will lay his hand on one on whom already the master's eyes have been cast, that he or she shall be called to this place to help us." The professor closed the magazine, wrote in his diary, "My search is over," and he gave himself to the work of the Congo. The professor's name was Albert Schweitzer. He gave himself to the work in Africa. And that little article, hidden in a magazine addressed to someone else that had been placed by accident in Schweitzer's mailbox and his housekeeper had picked up and placed by happenstance on his desk that night, led him to his life's work. Dr. Schweitzer, of course, became one of the great figures in this century in a humanitarian work nearly unmatched in human history in Africa. Happenstance? Chance? No, that's providence. Pastor and author John Maxwell told that story and this one in his book, God's Troublesome Timing. I like that title, God's Troublesome Timing. Abraham Lincoln was out at the back of his store one day, rummaging through an old barrel. He was done rummaging when he reached in and he felt a couple of books in the bottom of the barrel. When he pulled them up, he saw that they were Blackstone's commentaries. He had little access to education, but he began to train himself from those and became a lawyer, and he got into politics, and then he became president of the United States, and he led the nation during the Civil War, and it may have all started with rummaging in the bottom of a barrel one day. God is the master of coincidence, the expert in timing. Fourth principle, God calls us to his service in surprising ways. Verse 15. Now, a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, About this time tomorrow I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he shall deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, Behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people. Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, Please tell me where the seer's house is. See, he doesn't even know who Samuel is. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. Really? And in the morning I will let you go, and will tell you all that is on your mind. And as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? For whom does all Israel desire? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? And Saul answered and said, Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? God is working with both Samuel and Saul on a need-to-know basis. God has clued Samuel in that he is about to meet the future king of Israel, but he hasn't clued Saul in yet, or at least he hadn't. When they meet, Samuel immediately tells Saul what he wanted to know without asking. Donkeys have been found, they're home, but there's something more important here. Saul is the one for whom all Israel desires. Who, me? Saul could not miss the importance of that expression. How did this donkey search turn into a search for me? What's going on? He's shocked, to say the least. But more surprises await him that evening. Samuel commands him to the sanctuary for a feast right then. He has arrived at the very moment when the feast is about to begin. Not even time to wash up. And not only are you invited to the feast, but guess what? You're the guest of honor. You know, you may have not have had your power for 3 days. You may like to have a shower. Well, guess what? You're the guest of honor at this feast. And you've got to be there. Look at verse 22. Then Samuel took Saul and his servant. He brought them into the hall. He gave them a place at the head of those who were invited, who were about 30 men. And Samuel said to the cook, Bring the portion that I gave you, concerning which I said to you, set it aside. Then the cook took up the leg and what was on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, Here is what has been reserved. Set it before you and eat, because it has been kept for you until the appointed time, since I said I have invited the people. So Saul ate with Samuel that day. Now, it's quite possible that Samuel has set up, with God's direction, the representatives for the nation of Israel. Remember, the elders of Israel had come to him. They had been asking for a king. He'd sent them home, said, We'll take care of that. It's quite possible that these 30 men were the representatives of the nation of Israel, invited for a special feast that night. At the very least, they are certainly the leaders of the local area who have been gathered by Samuel for a feast and promised a guest of honor whom Samuel didn't even know who that was until God told him the night before. And Saul certainly didn't know it. Saul is the future king of Israel. His hometown will soon own the palace of a king, but he didn't know it. Now that's a surprise party. God kept it a surprise even from the principal participants in the surprise. Samuel had to trust God as he made all of those arrangements for Saul, as he set up the dinner, as he invited the 30 men, as he told the cook to set aside, and in those days, the leg was the favored piece. It was primarily, it was actually the priest's portion of a sacrifice. And here it was reserved. It was set aside for the guest of honor. But I don't know who that guest of honor is, God. Don't worry about that. Need to know. He'll be there. The cook has set it aside. The cook brings it and gives it to Saul. And notice the key expression there in verse 24. The cook says, because it has been kept for you until the appointed time. The appointed time. This moment. God has orchestrated all of this for this moment. God has set all of this aside for this appointed moment. This was God's appointed time for Saul. God is sovereign. He is the master of coincidences. As believers, we have to trust Him to direct our steps like Samuel, even when he didn't understand God's directions, like Saul when he was totally clueless. God is the master of coincidences. Human coincidences lead to divine appointments. February 19, 2002, Vonetta Flowers made Olympic history. She became the first person of African descent, American or otherwise, to medal in the Winter Games when she and teammate Jill Bakken jumped into a speeding bobsled and hurled themselves downhill in record time, winning the gold medal for the USA women's team. Vonetta instantly became a celebrity. In the whirlwind of press coverage that followed the competition, she was interviewed constantly. We didn't sleep for 2 days, she remembers. She was named one of People magazine's 50 most beautiful people. She traded quips with Katie Couric and Matt Lauer on the Today Show. Under all of that spotlight, there was one message that Vonetta repeated time and time again. It was this: I thank God for this win, because without Him, I wouldn't be here. But she wasn't just saying that like a lot of athletes say it. She meant it. Vonetta's story began many years earlier at the age of 9, when it was obvious she had athletic skills and she was singled out for track and field competition. And she was trained. And she was so gifted as an athlete that she eventually went to the University of Alabama at Birmingham on a full athletic scholarship for track and field. She was a runner. She became the school's most decorated student athlete and the first person from her family to graduate from college. In 1996, her dream was to be a U.S. Olympian on the U.S. Olympic track and field team. But she came in 13th in the Olympic trials because of ankle injuries that kept her from racing as fast as she could. When I failed to reach the Olympics in 96, I started to question my fate, Vonetta remembers. I'd achieved a lot of success in track and field based on my individual efforts. I believed if I trained hard enough and stayed healthy, that would be enough for me to make the Olympic team. I didn't yet realize I needed God in my life to help me find my purpose and to understand that what He wanted for my life was far greater than anything I could ever have imagined. The following year, in her discouragement, she started attending church with a friend. Before I became a Christian, she said, I didn't feel like a bad person, but I was lost. The decision to accept Christ as my Savior meant I was going to follow Jesus' footsteps day in and day out. My Bible became more than a book I carried to church on Sunday. God's Word came to life, and I turned to it often for strength. In 1999, Vonetta married fellow athlete and pastor's kid, Johnny Flowers. They believed that God was in control of her athletic career, and with Johnny at her side serving as coach, she began training again with the hopes of making the 2000 Olympic team. But in 2000, just 4 months before the Olympic trials, she underwent her fifth ankle surgery in 8 years, and her dream was over. Once again, she didn't make the team. Then her husband, Johnny, just happened to see a flyer advertising that some of the Winter Olympic bobsled team were looking for track and field athletes who might be willing to come to Germany and train for the bobsled. They sent it in. 2 weeks later, she received a phone call. I'd like you to come to Germany to learn how to push a bobsled. The woman offered the invitation was Bonnie Warner, a world-class bobsled driver. After several weeks learning alongside other hopefuls, she was offered the position of brakeman in Bonnie's two-person sled. By the end of 2001, the two were ranked third in the world. It looked like Olympics at last, in a totally different discipline, but at least the Olympics. Then Bonnie dumped Vanetta for another brakeman. "I was devastated," she said. For almost 2 weeks, she didn't do anything. Her dream was over again. But then Johnny stepped in. He said, "God put you in this sport for a reason, so we're going to start training again." "I'm like," Vanetta says, "I'm like training for what? I'm off the team." But he just kept saying, "God put you in this sport for a reason." Vanetta was dubious, but she started training again. "I'd forgotten who's in charge," she says. "It's not me. God's in charge, and he knows how everything is going to turn out." A week later, she received a phone call from Jill Bakken, the number two driver in the world, asking Vanetta to join her team. And together, Vanetta and Jill made it to the 2000 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. The night before what would be their history-making run, Vanetta got another phone call. This time from Gene Racine, the number one driver in the world, asking Vanetta to leave Jill, join her sled, and win the gold medal. Was she tempted? No. She said, "I was loyal to Jill. I'd been loyal to Bonnie before that, even though she wasn't winning all the races." She said, "Even if Jill and I would have finished last, I would have been happy with my decision to stay." But of course, they finished first and won the gold medal. Vanetta refuses to give in to the pressure of expectation. She says this, "I just put my faith in God and let Him take over. I do my job of training. I put the rest in His hands. God's in charge. He knows how everything is going to turn out." Can you say that? Father, sometimes life takes many twists and turns we do not understand. There are coincidences we cannot explain. Help us to understand that those coincidences, those circumstances, lead to your appointments in our lives and to follow you wholeheartedly and to trust you as the one who knows the end from the beginning. In Jesus' name.